It's time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
Where too much networking would never be enough.
A podcast on the data networking industry. Routing, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Are you ready?
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology, and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we gather articles and information and then get together to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the network world with humour, wit, and possibly even some technical talent. And of course, our world-class pool of resources are here again this week to do business. Welcome back, Ethan. How's your week been?
Good week. Starting off this week with some great weather here in New Hampshire, where it's no longer hot and humid like it has been all summer long. It is now nice and cool. It feels like fall. I'm very excited about that because that means for me the hiking season is going to ramp up. I like to hike in the White Mountains here in New Hampshire, and I don't really like to do it when it's hot and there's a lot of bugs out this weather, and then it starts getting colder at 9 and we start getting some snow, and that's hiking season for me. So I'm pretty excited about all that.
Outstanding. And it's a public holiday there for you as well.
Yeah, it's Labor Day here in New Hampshire, which means we don't do any work. That's how it's supposed to work here in America.
So. I know that Americans get really excited about public holidays because you don't get any, whereas we get.
Yeah, there's between 10 or 12 a year, just depending on what company and how they observe things and so on. But right, as compared to over in the UK, we get less vacation and fewer holidays. It would seem. Seems like I have coworkers in Dublin, London and so on, and they seem like they're always off on holiday or vacation. I can never get a hold of these guys.
It's a good life. And Dan Hughes is back again this week. How are you, Dan?
I'm good, Greg. I'm good. I've just spent the day, well, not the day, I mean the non-working day, of course, playing with my shiny new MacBook Pro, which turned up this morning.
Yay so, for you!
Yay for me. I'm very excited about that. Now I just have to get it borged into the corporate image and get all the nice features turned off. But apart from that, yeah, pretty good. Pretty good.
Well, welcome back to the world. So a couple of things this week. Packet Pushers is continuing to do its thing. Some of our growth slowed down a little bit this week. So if any of you have got some time to go up to iTunes and leave a comment, it's one of the best ways for us to grow the show and get in front of new people because it bumps the SEO. And if we can also ask you to get out there and tell your friends, and especially if you're part of CCNA or CCMP mailing lists, and put your name out there so that we can reach out to some new people and get them joining in our community. So far, it's been great, and we're really pleased that everybody's joining in. And particularly in the last week, we've seen quite a few more people write in and tell us about, ask us questions, and that gives us something to talk about because it can get a little hard to dream up articles to put on the show. Notwithstanding, of course, we've got things to talk about on the show this week. And first of all, this week wouldn't be remiss of us not to talk about VMworld, which went last week. Of course, VMworld is the VMware version of Cisco Live, where they announce all their new products. And, of course, VMware's got a big ecosystem, and all these different vendors raced in to announce products. It was a storage fest of huge proportions with storage vendors announcing products and... But we're a networking podcast, and who cares about packet generators?
I got to say, I unfollowed. I can't tell you how many people on Twitter this week. I was like, guys, I appreciate VMworld and all that. Just not enough to want to hear all this. I really don't want to know.
They're very chatty, the virtualization guys. They love to tweet. And generally, they do have a social media strategy, which Cisco should be embarrassed not to have something similar. Where they literally reach out to people and encourage them to participate in social media, and they have a whole division of people dedicated to it. But that's a different story. But the main thing that I wanted to bring up out of VMworld is that Cisco was there announcing their new product called the Virtual Security Gateway. Now, I've sent some documents out to you guys, which Cisco was very good to supply to us. Have you had a chance to have a look at them and work out what's going on there?
Took a glance at those. Also found a really good introductory video on YouTube that had been posted by one of the Cisco guys. I think it was recorded at VMworld, and also an article that Omar Sultan had posted up on the Cisco Data Center blog to talk about it. So, yeah, interesting product if you're a shop that's into VM. into VMware heavily. You're vested in that, and you're also using Nexus 1000V. The virtual security gateway would be an interesting add-on to Coup. Really, it's a host-facing firewall is kind of how I interpreted it, Greg. Is that kind of what you took away from it?
Yeah, it's using an interesting technology. The idea is, of course, in a virtualized data center that you have a VMware operating system, the hypervisor, and then you have an operating system sitting inside of that. What you want to be able to do is if that guest OS migrates from this virtual machine to that virtual machine, you want the networking stuff to go with that instance, that virtual instance as it migrates, that virtual box. So how do we make a firewall go from there to there when it might be on a different layer 2 segment? It might be in a different part of the data center. So what you're looking at here is an attack on that, where we're saying the firewall is actually attached to the virtual, to the guest OS, to the virtual instance. And Cisco's way of attaching that to the virtual instance is to use the Nexus 1000V. Anybody else want to have a go at explaining Nexus 1000V?
I think you've kind of described most of its functionality in that it's a software switch that replaces the sort of the virtual switch you get with VMware by default. But as you say, the key thing with it is that the configuration follows the VM. So, you know, you have your two hosts running VMware, you configure a switch port, and if your instance moves from one box to another, the switch port goes with it. It avoids a lot of little problems you kind of get where, you know, if you've maybe not configured everything exactly the same and trying to keep it all synchronized across lots of different hosts. It's a nice product. I've always been slightly curious about it in terms of the concept of actually moving to a software switch, given all these vendors have been telling us for years that the only way you can do switching is in hardware, and then all of a sudden you get a software switch comes along and it's the best thing since sliced bread. Kind of curious about that, but...
Well, this firewall too is really doing the same thing. It's no longer a physical appliance you rack up. It's a piece of virtualized software that's utilizing the hardware resources of that cluster that all the VMware infrastructure is riding on for for all of its data. So, I mean, you've gone from virtualizing hosts, and now we're beginning to virtualize network appliances.
Well, this isn't the first case of this. The thing to remember here is that you can already buy Bluecoat WAN accelerators, Riverbed WAN accelerators, Viata routing instances, I believe F5 appliances. So you can actually buy virtual instances of network appliances today.
But they're still the same appliances, just without the tin. Whereas this is actually taking the function of them and pushing it down into the infrastructure. Mm. So it is slightly different.
Well, this is a little bit different because it actually attaches directly to the hypervisor kernel. So it uses something, as I understand it, and I could be wrong here, and we'll find out more as time goes by. I believe it uses something called... that's different. This is the vShield, which I'll come to in a minute. This uses the kernel drivers, which the Nexus 1000V attaches to. So... if I try and break the Nexus 1000V down, there's a thing called a supervisor piece of software, which is a separate instance somewhere in your network. And it acts a lot like a supervisor module in a 6500 or a Nexus 7000. It's the central control plane for the switching engine. And then you take the Nexus 1000V software agent, install it into VMware, and it replaces the vSwitch and the vDistributed switch, so that the Nexus 1000V now becomes a switching infrastructure. Once that switching software is installed, it then reports back to the Nexus 1000V supervisor to receive its configuration. Because the 1000V is attached to the VMware kernel, if the guest OS migrates from one chassis to another, VMware then signals to the Nexus 1000V to take that configuration over there. And the Nexus 1000V supervisor then makes changes in the networking to keep the VLANs and so forth coherent within the rule set. Now, I could well be being wrong there, and I'm sure there's people out there who are cringing at what I said, but that's my understanding of how it works. Now, the virtual security gateway uses the same hooks of the 1000V to apply some part of the ASA code base. I'm led to believe it's loosely based on the ASA, but it's a different thing. It doesn't run as an autonomous instance. It actually sits inside the pathways of the VMware networking stack. And it's a little bit early to tell how it's going to look and what it's going to run like, but my understanding is that inside of the 1000V, it's configured a lot like the ASA firewall with similar CLI. And it appears as though, conceptually, if you want to think of it loosely, as the Nexus 1000V supervisor as being a slot, and then each virtual machine is another slot in the chassis, then one of those slots will be a firewall slot, and you'll be able to configure the firewalls here. So the perhaps the most interesting part about this is that VMware also announced its new product in this space in exactly the same product space called VShield version 2. They've had previously had a VShield version 1, and VShield version 2 is not only a firewall, but it's also a malware scanner. It does antivirus and malware offload from the operating system. One of the big problems with virtual machine instances is that you get the 3 o'clock in the morning VMware loadout where the CPU and the memory burst as they all run their virus scanning at the same time. Right when the backup's running. So you get this.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's when your storage has a problem. So there's these instances going on. And so it'll be interesting to see how the virtual security gateway from Cisco competes against the VMware VShield. I'm waiting for some more information to come out to see if we can find out more about that.
Oh, I think I can predict how that's going to go. I mean, VMware has really got the hearts and minds of the guys that are the closest to that infrastructure, which are the VMware sysadmins, the guys that are doing the virtualization. It seems to me that there is not a big install base of the Cisco virtualization stuff, kind of like Cisco modules for blade centers haven't sold as well as some of the alternatives. Since Cisco's not doing a single source or some kind of a special arrangement with VMware to market this exclusively as the one solution for the networking, and VMware seems to be going aggressively after networking products and becoming more of a networking company in addition to their bread and butter of virtualization. I'll be surprised if Cisco ends up as the leader with these sorts of things. But, I mean, time will tell, of course, but that's my prediction.
I have seen a few people sort of moving towards Cisco UCSF. I don't know. I can't see how the whole model is going to be successful against the sort of, the HPs and the people like that, to be honest with you. I just don't see how they're ever going to get the groundswell against the against the people who are going to buy this stuff. But the products we're actually talking about, I think it's clever. You know, the good thing I like about it is the fact that you can now start to bridge your virtual environment between security zones. I suppose is the big thing that comes out of this. I don't know about yourself.
Cloud enabler, because if the firewalls are attached to the virtual machine can move around in the cloud. And so you'll be able to buy a machine and you can say it needs to have this firewall and then you need a load balancer and they'll instantiate a virtual load balancer. And you say you want a WAN accelerator and they'll instantiate another one of those. And then when they need to move around, they just all dynamically move around the pool of Intel resources is the coherent description of it that I can come up with.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But, I mean, I don't know about the ones you've seen, but I've seen a lot of instances with VMware where you sort of get a VMware infrastructure which is built for an internal application sort of zone, a VMware infrastructure that's built for maybe a PCI DSS compliant zone, another one that's going to be built for a web-facing zone.
Yes.
At least now you've actually got the possibility of just building one VMware infrastructure and sticking a firewall between it, which is kind of... nice.
Just to add confusion to the picture, of course, is that there's two new standards coming down the pipeline, 802.1 QBH and 802.1 QBG. I'm still learning about these because I found out about them at the HP thing I went to recently, and they are called VEPA, Virtual Ethernet Port Adapter, or something like that. I can't quite remember. In the standards, they're called bridge port extensions, and these actually create an Ethernet part of the MAC layer, which enforces forwarding out of the virtual chassis out to the switch and back again. So where inside a VMware you currently have a situation where there's a virtual switch and you can forward frames between the virtual instances inside the VMware chassis, there is an Ethernet standard coming which forces packets to come out of the virtual instance and then go out to the Ethernet switch before they can return to the machine on the same server. So there's no tromboning inside the chassis or inside the VMware instance. It's a little confusing. Cisco, it's presented to me as a standards way of enforcing a multi-tenant strategy. But the virtual security gateway in the Nexus 1000B uses a technology called VNLink. But Cisco seems to be re-enabling VNLink to support VEPA or 802.1QBG and 802.1QBH. So there's some standards work which is going on. I am hoping to get some briefings from Cisco in the future about how all this works together. So it's new. I think the message that I came away with is that networking is going to change over the next 2 or 3 years. We're going to see less appliances and more virtual instances. But when I looked carefully at this for a while, I thought, you know, does that mean networking is going to go away? Or is it just going to disappear? But now when I look at this, what I realize is the same skills that we have, we're still going to be firewalling and we're still going to be WAN accelerating and we're still going to be load balancing and we're still going to be routing and switching. It's just the systems that we run it on are going to be different, and we're probably going to be running them inside of a VMware environment using vCenter or potentially, you know, some other software platform from VMware.
The body of knowledge you have to have to be really good at networking is very large, and it becomes difficult to be good at everything. So if you're a guy that's really good at virtualization and you know how to take hosts and package them up and get them moved over and allocate resources well and virtualize your storage and be able to do it all redundantly and so on, that's occupying your life full time. Networking is the thing you got to get done so that the plumbing works, and it's really annoying when it doesn't work and you probably don't want to know too much more about it necessarily. I'm sure that there are those guys that do, don't get me wrong, but generally speaking, the job of virtualization is going to keep those guys occupied. And I agree, Greg, that, yeah, those of us that are doing networking are what we're looking at on the monitor screen may change a little bit. The interface may be a little bit different. Now we have to know a little bit about vCenter and hop in there and click on some different things. At the end of the day, we're going to end up doing the same tasks, security and routing and switching and optimizing for capacity and making sure things are redundant and so on. That's all going to be there, and we're still going to have to be able to do that job. But there's this rough transition period that we're going through now. I was thinking when you were rattling off these different 802 dot whatever standards that are coming out now, it's like, man, this was not like this. Even a year ago, it wasn't really like this. And with this great big push, everyone talking about the cloud and virtualizing and so on has brought about this need, this driver for all of these different new technologies. And there's different competing ideas out there, and vendors are getting into all these contests on Twitter. It's funny to read them sometimes going, no, I didn't say that. I said this and you misread me. And I can't take you seriously. Is there going back and forth on some standard that doesn't even exist yet, except in someone's mind, because it's so far from reality and being widely deployed. There's just a select few people that are playing with this stuff right now.
Yeah.
It's really exciting.
I can remember back when I first started in networking in 96. And in 96, we had to learn ATM, FDDI, Token Ring, ARCnet, and Ethernet. And
you rode a horse to work.
You had a horse.
I can remember when we started having FDDI to Token Ring translational bridging. And, you know, there was new things to learn all the time. I think my instant reaction to what you just said about, you know, all of a sudden we've got new changes and things, I can remember back to a time when networking changed so fast it was impossible to keep up. And back in sort of like 98, we had FDDI to Token Ring translational bridging and Token Ring to Ethernet source
bridging.
We settled
into kind of a groove, didn't we, with Ethernet switching kind of got settled in, and the only thing that were changing were the speeds, the topologies, and the way we did interconnects and so on. We've seen changes in the WAN where it's gone from frame relay and ATM to MPLS, but to an enterprise guy, it kind of doesn't matter. You've still got some plug that goes off to a carrier, and you don't really care how it gets to the other side so much. I mean, so largely things haven't changed for the enterprise guys, and now there are things that all of us have to be paying attention to and keeping up with, and virtualization is driving it.
Well, there's a lot of change in some very fundamental technologies here. You know, new standards. I mean, we're talking about the death of spanning tree. at the end of the day, then there's two competing technologies to replace it. So there's a technology called Trill, and there's a competing standard from the DCB. I can't think of it. Ivan Pepeljak over at iOS Hints was talking about it today, that there's a difference between DCB refers to quality of service, and so Ivan Pepeljak had a post today, data center bridging and Trill have nothing in common. And he's quite correct. Trill is one technology for shortest path bridging, and there's another one called 802.1AQ. These are two competing standards for shortest path bridging across the data center. Now, for the last 20 years, we've had spanning tree and various spanning tree enhancements. So we've had, you know, the basic 802.1D, and then they came along. Cisco came along with Backbone Fast and Uplink Fast and Port Fast and various proprietary optimizations, and then we had rapid spanning tree, and then we had multiple spanning tree, and you know, Cisco had their per VLAN, and it's been very easy to follow that progression. And now we're actually looking at the death of spanning tree and a choice between Trill or 802.1AQ to give you a shortest path bridging across the backbone. So multipath load balancing at Ethernet at layer 2 across a switched backbone core in the data center. That layer 2 coherence is being driven by VMware and the ability to migrate machines transparently around the data center. And this comes back to the virtual security gateways, where firewalls will be attached to virtual instances, and that function and will migrate with those, you know, as they move around a pool of resources. So it's going to be an interesting couple of years. This isn't going to happen, you know, by the end of the year. It's not going to happen by the end of next year. We're talking 2 or 3 years before it stabilizes. The people who are going to have pain are the people who are designing data centers in the next 18 months, who are going to have to make decisions around choosing one or the other of these before the clear winner is chosen.
That's exactly it. Because this is a transitional period, how do you gamble? You're going to drop hundreds of thousands of dollars on, say, a Cisco Nexus infrastructure or a new HP core or something like that. What technology do you bet on? Because there's always the concern with some of this new stuff. Hey, I implemented today. It works. It does what I need. And then in a year, the vendor announces, yeah, we're not doing it anymore. You know, do I buy Betamax or VHS? Do I buy HD DVD or Blu-ray? If someone's going to lose and you're in a position where you are having to make that choice because that person hasn't lost yet, whoever it's going to be, it's a lousy spot to be in. It really is.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it will come down to vendor selection. I mean, you know, if you sort of stay on the Cisco line, the way they're pushing the, is it Fabric Path that they're calling Trill?
Yep.
You know, to an extent, there'll be a case if you pick your vendor that makes the technology decision for you, as of course was the case with the HDTV, sorry, the Blu-ray versus.
Yes.
You know. But for those who are sort of going out and looking at non-Cisco products, you've probably got a little bit, you know, slightly tougher decision to make, I'd say. Which, of course, Cisco will be loving in terms of the buy safe, buy Cisco kind of message. But
well, I think that's going to change because we're seeing the rise of the stack. So what I mean by stack, some people call it the stack. I call it a stovepipe, where you can go, for example, to Hewlett-Packard and buy their storage, their servers, their network, their professional services, and they'll present you with one target for risk management.
And again, that gives you your answer. I mean, if you go the HP route, and if they have a, you know, a standard design for doing this, then you're going to be getting their standard design, and they'll hopefully stand by it for X number of years until it's time to buy a new one.
Cisco's got the same thing because they've partnered with EMC. So the Cisco EMC partnership means they've got EMC VMware. Cisco's got the servers and the networking, and EMC's got the virtualization software and the storage. So they provide a stovepipe. Then you've got Dell, who was trying to buy 3PAR to get a viable high-end storage array. So they'll now go and look for some other storage company to boost their high-end storage so that they can provide a virtualization stack. And IBM, of course, is still casting around for their answer. They have their servers. They're currently OEMing Cisco's networking products and Juniper's and Brocade, I believe. And they OEM them and paint them black and put their logo on them. But they'll have the IBM XIV storage, which is very high-end and a lot of people are very popular. And there's some hidden players in here. Hitachi, for example, recently came out and announced that they have networking products through a joint venture with NEC that are huge in Japan. They have their own servers, which are only in Japan, and they have their HDS storage array, which is very popular worldwide. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. So to come back to these things, the virtual security gateway, there is another product from VMware called vShield. So we are going to see virtualization and networking clash, as the VMware people say, oh, well, we want to use vShield because it comes from VMware, and Cisco's going to be here with their virtual security gateway, which is going to offer a different feature set but with overlapping functionality. It's going to be an interesting head-to-head. Could be a rather challenging viewpoint for networking guys, because we'll still be needed to do the networking, and there is still networking inside of VMware with this new standard 802.1 QBH and QBG stuff that's coming down the pipe.
I will say the next certification I want to go after is something from VMware. I gotta wrap my hands around that technology, those interfaces, and what they're doing. I keep running into situations at work where I'm being asked questions about, you know, I've got this networking problem, you know, and those guys don't know the switches, and I don't know the VMware well enough. We work together and we sort it out, but it's painful. Where I'm like, okay, well, take me to the screen where you provision this VLAN or this IP address, and they're clicking through six things and 12 tabs, and I finally, you know, see what it is I'm looking for, and so on. I really got to get to the point where I know that product as well as these guys do that use it every day, so that I can help troubleshoot network problems more effectively. It's the single biggest hole in my knowledge right now that is making me less effective at my job than I want to be. And I think it's only going to get, I know it's only going to get worse, because we got a data center full of servers that we're virtualizing right now. Mm-hmm. It's all going away. We're taking it down from, we're going to end up with 20% of the racks that we used to have when it's all said and done. If things stay on track and go according to plan, everything's going to be virtualized. Really feel like I've got to know VMware so I can speak their language and translate what I know about networking into VMware speak better.
I've done a couple of VMware things on my own bat and learned some of what I needed to know. I don't claim to be a networking guru, but I didn't find VMware particularly challenging to adapt to. It's not complicated or complex. As long as you have a good grip on networking theory, it's not hard to master. It's not like it's from Mars, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. It's you don't know what you don't know, though, and that's in that boat right now, where I haven't had the chance to just sit down and spend the time with it, because I'm still dealing with 7-year-old firewalls and 10-year-old hybrid 6500s that desperately need replacement. So that's occupied the vast majority of my cycles. But that's encouraging to hear that once I do have the chance to get into it, it's not going to be that hard, because at the end of the day, networking is networking.
It's fairly straightforward.
Think of it this way. Server guys can work it out, so if they can work it out.
they can't, though. That's the problem. I mean, I am actually, I'm content to let them sort it out, but they can't, because of that's where their knowledge begins to end, is with a lot of the networking stuff. Well, geez, I assigned the right IP and my default gateway's right, and I think I got this whole VLAN thing sorted, and maybe VLAN, it's a switch port. Let's move the switch port. Try that. Let's try this. Let's try six other things that have nothing to do with the actual issue, which is something, you know, screwed up in the host or, you know, the NIC, something like that. A lot of times it becomes a not that there's animosity involved, but it is a little bit of a game of finger pointing. You know, hey, you plugged a laptop into the switch port I provisioned for you, and everything works. You plug your VMware host in, and it doesn't. So the solution is, let's move the switch port? What? No. Come on. Think about what you just said. I've had those sorts of conversations. They're getting friendly. You know, no one's upset, because we're all just trying to get the job done at the end of the day. But there's a bridge there that's got to get crossed on both sides.
I think what we're going to find really is, as these technologies merge in together, you're going to find that a sort of a group of professionals will appear who do have the full skill set, maybe not to the same level of depth, but you are going to have to know virtualization pretty damn well. You're going to have to know, especially these sort of with these new virtualized hardware NICs that are coming out and things like that, where the troubleshooting is going to be an absolute pig. You're going to have to get to know storage. You're going to have to get to know storage networking. And it's kind of, to an extent, a question of, who's going to learn this? Is this going to be network guys who are going to learn this, or is this going to be server guys? I think it's probably just going to be the bright guys will learn it, or those that care will learn it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary. And I think also that networking guys are often bright. in my experience, they're often more aware of the entire environment. Because we sit underneath everything, we see windows, we see storage, we see business process, we see applications being deployed. Whereas servers can live slightly in slightly more remote from storage. We tend to sit in the middle of them all, and often networking people have a better visibility of all things. That's not always true. I mean, there's notable exceptions, but as a fairly broad brush observation, I generally find networking people are more aware of servers and storage and printers and desktops and firewalls and internet than other people in the organization. And we often have a bigger picture than perhaps other people do.
There's a top-down view that naturally comes along with having that great big network map all in your head, and especially if you're the one that designed it. That's a natural extension of that big network map, is knowing what's connected to it and how it all works together. Yeah.
Yeah. So we often have a view that nobody else has. So we'll keep tracking that, and no doubt we'll keep talking about it more in the future. Transitioning on to the next topic, there's a company called Sigo, that's X-S-I-G-O, and those of you who've listened know that I'm a bit of a fan of Sigo and their InfiniBand products. This, during the VMworld, they announced their RDMA over CEE. This is called their Rocky, R-O-C-E-E. This is a slightly different virtualization technology. It's quite separate from the Ethernet technology that we've talked about so far, where we use a technology called VNLink, which provides separate virtualized channels down an existing Ethernet layer using a tag frame, which is the way Cisco does it. RDMA is a technology that InfiniBand invented, which uses direct memory access. So what you are actually doing is, if you want to transfer data between two computers, you actually write it into a memory location in the other machine over there, remote direct memory access. Up until now, InfiniBand has been the only networking technology, I believe, that's allowed you to do that. The advantage of direct memory access is that you don't generate a CPU interrupt when you want to transmit a packet over the network. So normally, in a side of the server architecture, when the network driver wants to push a packet out, sorry, when the operating system wants to transmit a packet, it creates a CPU interrupt to call the network driver to send the data so that it can be chunked up, and then the CPU then chunks up the data and then pushes it out the network driver. Remote direct memory access allows the data to transition directly from the memory location of the application across over a network directly to a memory location in another server, and that's how it's transmitted. This makes it extremely fast, very low CPU, a very low latency because there's no drivers, there's no anything. By announcing that they're going to extend RDMA over Ethernet, CEE is IBM's proprietary term for data center bridging, or DCB. CEE is Converged Enhanced Ethernet. So what they're essentially saying is, we're going to allow this remote direct memory access technology over Ethernet. The great part about this technology is it just uses anybody's Ethernet to create a secure multi-channel, multi-tenant capable technology without using VLAN tagging. So those of you who are deep into the security and PCI compliance, and you want to have virtual machines, or you want to have systems which are fully separated but sharing networking infrastructure, have a look at RDMA over CEE and the Sigo products, which are really quite interesting with their announcement. You guys familiar with this, or am I just completely on a track of my own here?
On track of your own here.
No, I was looking at Zigo's site. I was going to try to get caught up with where you're reading. It didn't spot. They have no press release on their site for that product that I can see. Sounds interesting. I wanted you to expand on how it, you know, because you said, you know, shops that are, you know, PCI compliant. I came from a shop like that. You know, where that's a big concern. How does this help with that bit? Because what I was hearing was, okay, we can use Ethernet to move
directly from the memory across the PCI bus into the network adapter without being intervened by the CPU.
Which sounds like a performance enhancer for sure, but not a security enhancer. So where's that piece of it?
It doesn't use shared Ethernet technology to write data across the network. So the problem with shared multi-tenant architectures on Ethernet is that we rely on VLANs. PCI regards VLANs as inherently insecure because the untagged VLAN is always vulnerable to attack. The fact that Sigo uses RDMA, which is a completely separate, creates multiple virtual channels right above the networking stack, up in the operating system layer, can effectively create separated multi-tenant environments. Hard to explain.
I'd be curious to know what's actually going across the wire then, or is there anything going across the wire? Is it all contained within a cluster?
It's Ethernet, yes. So okay. Seago has a thing called a top of director, which is a top of rack switching solution. And previously that's been based around using InfiniBand, using quad data rate and dual data rate cards, where we're talking 20 gigabit, 40 gigabit line rates with very low latency. This now says we can now do exactly the same benefits of InfiniBand, which is the RDMA, which is how high-performance computing clusters work. They don't transmit data over the network and then read it back off the wire. They just put data into each other's memory location so that they can communicate that way. It's very fast. And the operating system puts the data directly over the bus into the network adapter, which then drives it out. By putting it on top of Ethernet, doing this RDMA over Ethernet, they can now use anybody's gigabit NICs. So you could start with a 1 gigabit server NIC today from, you know, the Broadcom chip inside your Dell server, and then wind it up to 10 gig tomorrow with a fancy 10 gig NIC or a simple 10 gig NIC, and then take it up even further to 20 or 40 gig using InfiniBand if that's what you want as your performance cranks up. And this, the director class switch, which goes into the top of rack, then has a fiber channel or a 10 gig or a, and breaks out to other things, and it allows the connectivity. The metaphor starts to break down at this point, and you really need to get into the product. By all means, get a hold of Seago and mention packet pushers when you do, because they'd like to know where you heard about them. But they're a very exciting company. They've got some serious investors in behind them.
Yeah, I think the thing that just dawned on me as I'm looking at the blog article about this that you sent me the link on is that this isn't just for packetizing standard TCP/IP communications. You can use this Ethernet to packetize all sorts of different things. Is that what I'm
gathering?
So
it's a converged networking capability. So you can converge both storage data and IP data onto this.
And they're saying whatever else you want, an FCOE module, fine. You want to do, any number of things. They're saying it's modular, right. and you're going to be able to put in a whole lot of stuff at some point, presumably FCOTR support eventually. So that's
absolutely
when
FCOTR ships in hardware, as we've had some undertakings from, they'll have an adapter available for that.
Nice.
So this might make a good point to talk about my fact of the week this week. As I was working on some Nexus switches, I finally realized that the Nexus 7000 software no longer implements that legacy feature of reserving VLAN numbers 1001, 2, 3, 4, and 5. They are now available for use. For those of us who remember back long enough and far enough, we remember that those VLANs were reserved for FTDI translational bridging and token ring concurrent route, CRB, and so forth. And that's what they'd been reserved for in the operating system as legacies ever since. And Nexus finally releases those VLANs for good. I was a bit surprised when I realized that, but I thought it was a neat thing in the end. Huzzah. Oh, God, we're excited.
I think the best thing is it's just another little thing you're not going to have to remember for exams.
Huzzah. And I'd like to introduce our sponsor, Ascolta Training. Ascolta Training is an award-winning Cisco Learning Solutions partner in the United States, offering a range of Cisco courses on multiple technologies. Using Cisco's advanced course material and strong customer focus, they provide top-notch training solutions and have good customer satisfaction ratings. Using a variety of delivery methods in the United States to meet your unique needs and their extensive public class schedule, Ascolta excels at delivering and developing client-specific and customized training to fit your environment. They are partners for Cisco for course development, and with well-known and industry-experienced instructors like Brandon Carroll, who you would know has been on the show before, they deliver public training courses and private on-site training. Ascolta has the right solution for you. You can find them on the web at www.ascolta.com or on their blog at blog.ascolta.com, and also on Twitter, surprisingly, as at Ascolta, A-S-C-O-L-T-A. Mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you book a class, and you'll receive a $250 discount to get you started. That's a Sculptor Training, and they want you to learn something.
So we had an email come in from one of the listeners, Andrew, whose last name I will not even attempt to pronounce. My apologies, Andrew. But the message reads this. Hey, guys, love the show and everything you talk about. Just a quick question about project planning and preparation. How much time do you guys typically take to implement a new technology into a live network? I am a telephony and network consultant, and I'm always trying to find the right balance of preparing my configs and implementation plan in a lab to actual time on site. So I like as much time as I can to lab, et cetera, but I don't want him to run any problems on cutover day. At the same time, I don't want to put too much time in into labbing it out or overthinking it. How do you find that balance? You know, when is it okay to shoot from the hip? So that was his question. Do you guys do a lot of lab work? When you go to implement something, what kind of things qualify for lab stuff and what kind of things do you just go ahead with when you make a change?
I think a lot of it is down to the how big of a change it is to your existing infrastructure. If you're taking an established design and just adding to it, so, you know, if you've let's say a switch network with a core and, you know, connecting access switches into it. You know, if you're adding in another access switch, then there should be nothing revolutionary in that. I've said before, I'm a huge believer in standardization. So I mean, I suppose the one thing I would put a lot of time into is making sure that every single one of my access switches is built from the same template. So, you know, you literally have a template that you take out, you put in the IP address, the host name, and you ship it onto your the router. If you're doing that kind of stuff, you're not really changing anything. You're merely adding. If all of a sudden you decide you want to add in, say, a distribution layer into your network because you've got too many access switches now, then that's something you're going to have to do an awful lot of lab work with for two reasons. One, to actually prove the concept of your actual design and work out how you're going to do your load balancing, how you're going to work out your different scaling sort of aspects to it. But the big thing is how you're going to add it into your environment without breaking anything, and to actually be able to turn around to your project manager, your manager, whoever, and say, okay, here are the steps we're going to have to do, guys. These are the bits where we're going to cause an outage. These are the bits where it's a low risk. These are the bits that are high risk. And the only way you're going to get that is through labbing it up and kind of learning a few of the lessons on the lab itself.
I agree with that. That's the where I've spent the most energy in a lab is exactly that. I have got to do something that's a fairly traumatic change to the network. It's bringing up new links. It's turning up a new bit of hardware. It's a new whatever it is that's being done. When we do this, whatever the step's going to be, I need to be able to report we did this in the lab on the exact same equipment running the exact same versions of iOS, or as close as you could come to it because we did it with GNS kind of a setup. Mm-hmm. This is how the outages went. This is what we did to make sure those were minimal outage times. We did this and it was hitless. You know, we did this and we lost one ping or whatever it was, however you quantify that and get right to that point. And when we could, and one of the things that Andrew is asking here, how do you know when you've really done enough time in the lab and you're not overanalyzing it? To me, it's when I can repeat that process over and over again with the same results every time, and then I have someone else come and look and say, am I missing anything here? Is this a fair replication of our production environment? Because sometimes you can do a lab exercise and it's great, and you forget about that one weird thing in production that you're not really replicating that well. That another eyes go, yeah, you forgot about the that set of static routes that we have here for that. Oh, crap, I forgot about that. And then you put them in, and it can change the results of your lab experiment quite a bit.
What about the use of test plans? Do you typically, when I'm working through the design process, I'll be carrying a document with notes about things that I'm uncomfortable with or unhappy with and that I need to have tested and validated, and then hand that into the process where we build a lab and make sure. And so I'll have a list of things that would have occurred to me while I'm researching the design and gone, you know, I don't trust this feature, I don't trust that feature. Building a test plan for me is really important.
Now, a test plan meaning I want to be able to check all these boxes saying I verified this, I checked this, I tried this command, and, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
I mean, so you sit and build something like that, like off the top of your head, or is there a more formal process you go through to build that plan?
I build it as I research a product. So as I build a design, you know, 10 switches, 30 top of racks, this cabling infrastructure. And it will occur to me to check this, to check that, and there's this I haven't thought of. And if this software, you know, as I speak to a vendor, I realize the software is not stable. You know, somebody hints to you that this feature is not stable or that feature's not been proven. I make notes as I work through the design.
Yeah, so I'm nodding my head, you know, in agreement with you, which no one can see, not even you guys. but yeah, that's the same. I do that same sort of thing as well, where I'll have, you know, my notebook that I'm working through, and I'll say, oh yeah, got to check this, got to verify this. I was reading up on this, and this is a problem. Someone did a blog article on this and pointed out, you know, these three things to consider. And I will write all those things down, because you forget. You won't remember to do it. You'll think, oh, you get all the way through your test plan. It's 2 days before the maintenance window. Oh, crap. I never did check that. Hope it doesn't bite me in the rear end. Off we go. Kind of thing. So if we're going to sum up Andrew, you know, the question to answer to Andrew's question here, I think, you know, what's a good amount of time to recommend? Well, come up with a test plan of the things that you need to check. Check them all. Make sure you can replicate that test process you've come up with in the lab. Have another set of eyes review your lab exercise. Make sure you're not missing something because you're a little too close to the work that you're doing. Shooting from the hip would be, for me, I'm never really comfortable shooting from the hip entirely, but I think, you know, as Dan was saying earlier, if it's a cookie cutter thing, you're just doing, you know, you're adding a new switch to the environment and you've got 100 of these switches that are already out there that follow the same template, then you're not really making a change, you're just adding something. And I think it's safe in that environment just to put it in, because you it's a known entity. You know what's going to happen. You know what's supposed to happen when you light that thing up. So, Andrew, hope that's helpful.
I also have allocated budget to testing. The amount of money you would tend to allocate to testing is in proportion to the risk. So if I'm running, let me tell you, I spoke to somebody once who had a story about a trading floor for one of the big, very big banks, where something like $1 trillion is traded across this trading floor every day. That takes them 5 years to design and build that trading floor, and then the day that it's deployed, it never changes for 5 years when it's replaced with the next generation of technology. I'm led to believe there are trading floors out there today which still run ATM because it took so long to get them tested and validated and to work through all of the possible scenarios and to make sure, you know, all that stuff. And the way they keep them secure is not to let any data into them that's not checked, but that's a different problem. It's most important. So if you've got that much at risk, it can literally take years to do testing. On the other hand, if you consider a small business network where it's much easier to just bang a change in, and if it goes wrong, you can just unwind it in 15 minutes because the impact is just, you know, a few minutes out for different people. So testing is always going to be proportional to the risk and the amount of money at stake and the risk to the business. Who makes that decision? That's a very difficult question. That's up to the business to understand that there could be a problem and to make a decision about how they feel about that. And it's also a decision you have to make about how you stake your career on these types of things and how you value your opinion, how many, like the opinion of the people around you. Do the server guys make fun of you when you melt down your network core? Things like that.
Do they make fun of you, or do they actually try to kill you?
Yeah. Or are they sympathetic because they, yeah. So there's no easily question to say budget is proportionally allocated to testing. It's up to the people who lead the business to say this is a significant risk, therefore we'll allocate significant budget to testing it. My philosophy has always been is if they don't allocate budget to it, then they don't regard it as a risk. And it's up to you to point that out to them, that they're taking a risk to not do testing, not you. And that's how you keep your job. Because then it's not your fault when it breaks. All right. I would like very briefly to talk about the Tech Field Day coming up next week, guys, because it is just 10 days until we get together in San Jose. And to say that myself and Ethan will be getting together in San Jose for the Tech Field Day with Gestalt IT. And we hope to be posting and blogging. Dan, unfortunately, you can't make it, can you?
I can't make it, I'm afraid. My mother-in-law broke her leg there, and she was my babysitting cover, so I'm stuffed.
That is a shame. We will be trying to get some time together to do a podcast for that week, and hopefully you'll be able to track in. I sure hope that we can get you there. And Ethan, you and I will get to meet for the first time in San Jose.
Yes, we've done a little video Skype, so we know what each other look like. Not that that's anything to... Maybe I just assumed you didn't know what I looked like. Anyway.
Well, we've all seen Greg on the video from HP now, so we know what he looks like.
He's a YouTube rock star.
Yeah, it's just so... The one where they introed us to the HP thing is I'm literally standing there introducing myself to the crowd, and this guy whips out a six-foot-long telescopic pole with a flip camera on the end, and he's literally holding it in front. He's behind my left shoulder, and he's holding it out in front of me, and I'm like, just through... That was the first one. The second one is with a proper video crew and somebody who seems to do the questioning. Was really quite off-putting. I'm not built for this sort of stuff. I'm just a guy who decided to write some rubbish for fun. So I am looking forward to the Gestalt IT field day, I must say. It's their very first network field day. We're going to be getting presentations from HP, from Juniper, which is going to be very interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing more about Juniper, even though I had a presentation this week. I know that there's a list of vendors which still haven't been announced, but hopefully Steve Foskett won't mind if I've told him. Some of the more interesting people who are coming along is Ivan Pepelniak and Terry Slattery. Many of you all know Terry from his blog. And, of course, people like Jennifer Hubert and Jeremy Stretch, Steve Ross and Josh Horton from Blind Hog, Jeremy Gaddis from Evil Rooters, Jeremy Philibin, who's also been one of our best people on the Packet Pushers podcast, and Brandon Carroll. So it's going to be a great week. I'd invite you all to join in. We're going to be with the vendors. If you've got questions when we get the presenting sponsors announced, feel free to start asking us questions. Be around on the day. Follow us on the Twitter and follow the hashtag, and you'll be able to ask us questions as we announce stuff. I'll be live blogging some of the sessions, so you'll be able to track some stuff there. And look forward to getting you participating in those things.
I'll be tweeting more than live blogging. But what Greg was just saying about questions, I mean, if you as a Packet Pushers listener want to take advantage of this field day and you're not actually there, the way to do it is to follow us on Twitter, follow Greg's live blogs. And then as you have questions, pop them up. We have opportunity to talk to the vendors one-on-one and quiz them. And we get the opportunity to ask hard questions, annoying questions, questions they may not want to hear. And get answers from. We're not talking to just the marketing people. There may be some marketing people around, but typically we're talking more to the high end engineers, guys that work with this technology all the time, understand how it works, what it's expected to do, what the roadmaps are, how you're supposed to implement it, and so on. So it is a really good opportunity for you if you're in Twitter or following Greg's blog or grabbing us via email, packetpushers@gmail.com. These are questions I want you to ask that vendor when you're there. Great. We'll see if we can do that.
That's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank Dan and Ethan for joining us this week. Ethan, what's going on with you this week?
I'll be headed back to work tomorrow and working on completing some new router rollouts, getting my F5 load balancers finally in production. They're about 90% there. I'll try to blog some more. I did a bit of blogging at packetattack.wordpress.com. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter @ecbanks to hear the latest and greatest horrible discovery I have found on this network that I took over back in April.
Dan's had to drop off early because of a microphone malfunction, but you can find him at blog.aloran.co.uk. And you can find him on Twitter as @rovingengineer. Keep in touch with him there. And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter as @etherealmind. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send us an email to packetpushers@gmail.com or check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net or follow us on Twitter @packetpushers. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.